يخلف الميعاد
إن الله لا يخلف الميعاد.
صدق الله العلي العظيم.
صدق الله العلي العظيم.
أحسنتم. Thank you so much. Brothers and sisters, dear listeners, thank you so much for being with us. Stay with IRB English Radio. Every day, inshallah, we'll be here with you talking about one of the verses of Surah Al-Ra'd and so on. That's it from us for today. Ali Nasir, Hassan and Hussein and Muhammad Masum. Thank you so much for being with us. See you in the next session. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah wa sallallahu ala sayyidina Muhammadi wa alihi al-tahirin.
اللهم صل على محمد وآل محمد اللهم صل على محمد وآل محمد
وعجل فرجه.
Let's recite the Quran, a joint production of IRIB English Radio and Xavier International Schools.
ذكر وموعظة ونور فيه شفاء للصدور وشفيعنا يوم النشور آياته تروي المدى وصفاته نبع الهدى نرقى الجنان بحبه لن تستقيم حياتنا إلا به هو القرآن والفرقان إليه تنصت الأكوان وفيه تعطر الآذان والقرآن.
To be
Have a good time. This is Iran Radio, and here are some interesting facts about Islam. The Islamic world produced the first skilled, specially trained pharmacists who made their own medicines and worked closely with medical doctors and physicians. A 13th century Islamic writer described the circulation of blood inside the human body some 400 years before this was discovered in Europe. One famous hadith Islamic saying is, Allah is beautiful and loves beauty. Beauty has always been, therefore, very important to Muslims and develops in the virtual arts such as architecture, calligraphy, painting, textile, metalwork, and ceramists were encouraged. Greetings once again, dear listeners, and thank you very much for listening to Iran Radio, coming to you from Tehran, the capital of the Islamic Republic of Iran. Let's take a quick look at what's coming up next on today's broadcast. We begin with A to Z of Life. After that, we present a specially selected edition of Radio Productions. Then stay tuned for Foresight, hosted by Sayyid Shahryar Naqvi. This enlightening program features prominent English-speaking scholars from across the Islamic world, focusing on the practical dimensions of worship and servitude to Allah, all within the context of modern-day challenges. It's an invitation to explore the intersection of faith and real-life responsibility. And finally, we bring you Ulama's speech. Coming up next, A to Z of Life. Stay with us. There is much to discover.
This is A to Z. An introduction into an Islamic lifestyle. Today's lesson, Mother. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim, welcome to A to Z here on Iron Bridge Radio with my sister Zainab. And well, so the title's Mother, and it's actually, I'm actually going to be talking about a particular aspect that's maybe totally different to what you think you're about to hear now. So this is not so much the idea of, because obviously I often talk about, you know, the dua of the mother, how important that is, but I'm actually talking about something different here. I'm talking about how, you know, obviously in our lives, maybe we have, for example, one of our parents. It could even be another family member, someone who's very close to us, for example. So, but typically, just to sort of hone in on someone who's really close to us, really special. So I just use the example of the mother. And I'll give an example from one of our martyrs too. You know, just imagine our mother is ill. And, you know, this is something that, you know, we would typically, well, we will probably talk about it. We'll probably mention it to maybe our friends, maybe even to colleagues. Maybe our mother, could be our father's become seriously ill, obviously during time the coronavirus times. Indeed, many of our family, some of our family members may have become very ill. People did lose mothers, fathers, other members of family or friends to corona, very sadly. Or maybe a mother or father, someone else has become ill, maybe has cancer. And you know, obviously our typical trait is to sort of talk about this. And there's nothing wrong with that. But obviously at the same time, it's sort of, we're sort of, it's as if, yeah, we sort of want that attention. It's just, in a sense, we want people to sort of give us the sympathy and the compassion and sort of to derive extra help from that. In a sense, and that in itself is still, there's nothing wrong with that. But I want to talk about another aspect of this. Welcome back to A to Z here on Iron Bridge Radio with me, Sister Zainab. And obviously I'm talking about this idea that maybe we sort of draw attention to things in our lives that are happening. we draw attention to particular hardships and challenges that we're going through. And, you know, this is not something that in itself is tricky, but I want to mention the opposite and then let us, let's say, we'll try and reflect on that and what lessons we can derive from that. So, for example, one of our martyrs of service, of national service, former president of the Islamic Republic of Iran, Shahid Raisi. So during his duties, it later turned out that, you know, his mother had, for example, become ill during the times of coronavirus, had got corona, but Shahid Raisi didn't let on about that, didn't say anything. Only afterwards, when he said, so alhamdulillah, his mother had recovered, was fine. And, you know, obviously people were wondering, well, why didn't you say anything? Why didn't you tell us? And, you know, so let's think back to our lives. And, yeah, typically when someone becomes quite ill, you know, if people will talk about it to others, and because maybe, you know, we also just want people to sort of maybe make dua for a member of our family. And obviously, but this is so this is a very particular thing. Obviously, in the case of, let's say, Shahid Raisi, it could have been any of the martyrs of the holy offense too. So they don't want to sort of draw attention to the fact that something difficult is going on in their lives, because they want to just sort of themselves focus on their duty, on their role. And they also don't want other people, for example, their colleagues, to even spend 1 minute thinking about what's going on in their lives and maybe have sympathy and talk about, you know, just have a sort of little conversation about their member of family who's ill. They want everyone to be solely focused on their job, on their role, on their task in hand. And we'd see this, for example, also with Shahid Chamran from the Holy Defense. He found out while he was actually there, literally at the battlefront, that one of his very good friends had been martyred, but he himself didn't show grief at that point because he also just wanted to just get on with his active role, and he saved his grief for nighttime. Yeah, so these are huge. This is obviously a very high level. So, inshallah, we can also gain some insights from this, and I look forward to welcoming you to another episode of A to Z here on Iron Mortgage Radio, and farewell for now. Thank you very much for listening to this episode of A to Z. And for more information, please also visit our website at www.iranradio.ir.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran.
Hello and welcome to a new episode of our program. I am delighted to welcome with us in this episode the representative from the Loyalty to the Resistance Bloc, Sheikh Hassan Izzeddin. Welcome, sir.
Thank you.
It's a pleasure. Today we mark the first anniversary of the Israeli aggression against Lebanon. This brutal assault began 10 days of darkness. For 10 days, there were devastating strikes against the resistance, from the pagers attack to targeting locations and attacking leaders, including the top-tier leaders. This included an attack on His Eminence Sayyid Hassan Nasrullah. Now, a year after this savage war, what conclusions can we draw? Have there been any results from Hezbollah's internal review regarding the outcomes of this war? What insights have emerged? What allowed the enemy to deliver such significant blows to the resistance in those initial days?
In the name of Allah, the Most Gracious, the Most Merciful. There is no doubt that what has happened can be summarized in many ways. I am trying to condense as much as possible what I understand about the situation. Firstly, gaining more knowledge about the enemy reveals that this enemy, whom we thought we knew, has changed and evolved. Whether it's military doctrine, strategy, or tactics, it has transformed and has also surpassed all norms of warfare. When a war arises, it disregards all international laws, and the global community has realized that the essence of this enemy in terms of ideology, faith, and politics is that it places no value on human life or any humanitarian considerations. This is evident from what it has done in the pagers attack. These electronic devices are used by both military forces and civilians. Therefore, even those who carry these pagers are part of the civilian society, living with their families, their fathers, mothers, brothers, and children. Consequently, we did not expect that this enemy would resort to such a devilish and criminal act. This criminal entity doesn't distinguish between the military and the civilian.
If you could turn back time to before October 7th, would you have handled the situation differently and avoided everything that happened, including what was referred to as the collapse of the resistance deterrent capability in the early days of the war?
If the intent of this question is regarding the support war that aided Gaza and defended Lebanon, then we have no regrets and will not regret it. To put it simply, the Palestinian issue is a matter of the entire nation. The sanctities of Palestine are the sanctities of the whole nation as well. Additionally, the injustice that has befallen the Palestinian cause is unimaginable, involving the extermination of a people, the displacement of a people, and the expulsion of a people from their land.
Yes, but if you knew that the cost of this support would be the collapse of Hezbollah's deterrence, the assassination of His Eminence Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah, the pagers attack, and the rest.
Because we cannot just sit back and watch the crime, genocide, and devastation on television. This is the first point. The second point is that we were fully aware that if this enemy succeeded in eliminating the resistance factions in Gaza, the next step would be Lebanon. This enemy has two grievances with Lebanon, the liberation in 2000 and the events of 2006. Therefore, we took a preemptive step to protect Lebanon and defend its people. This is also a response to all those who say that the resistance and the weapons are useless.
Regarding the resistance and its weapons being monitored from abroad, particularly some Lebanese factions claim that Hezbollah has been building its strength and power for 40 years. However, the deterrence and balance of power that it accumulated over the years collapsed in just 10 days. What do you have to say about that?
First, when we want to evaluate any topic, we should start from its journey to the moment it reaches. This means that this evaluation inherently responds to all the voices, both internal and external, that discuss the effectiveness of resistance and its weapons. In 1982, the Israeli enemy invaded Lebanon and occupied the second Arab capital. The Islamic resistance was born from the womb of occupation. There was no such thing as a double standard. This Islamic resistance arose as a reaction. The resistance began in 1982 and continued for nearly 18 years, managing to liberate Lebanese land after such a long time, a feat that neither diplomacy, international goodwill, the international community, nor Resolution 425 could achieve. It was the first Arab victory for the resistance against the Zionist enemy, an Arab victory without any privileges, conditions, or restrictions in neither security, political, military, economic, nor anything else. This was the first achievement. The second achievement is that the enemy, along with the Americans, the West, some Arabs, and some Lebanese, engaged in a global and universal war in 2006, yet they managed to endure and remain steadfast, preventing the enemy from achieving its goals. Since 2006 until 2023, we have seen a complete deterrent equation that the enemy could not overcome. So when we discuss this resistance and its weaponry, we must consider it in its entirety, from start to finish, during the period when Lebanon enjoyed prosperity, security, and stability. Ultimately, what happened was that this enemy managed to gain an advantage through technological superiority, artificial intelligence, and human security breaches. I mean, I'm aware of the capabilities I possess, which are capable of creating balance and engaging in a battle where I can achieve victory and inflict defeat on the enemy or prevent the enemy from achieving its goals. But on the other hand, the reality is that this enemy is constantly changing, meaning they are altering their combat doctrine, the methods, tactics, and strategies they employ. So our assessment may involve a certain level of misunderstanding or failure to grasp the true nature of the evaluation that should be made.
Before the incident of the pagers, the Israeli pager attack, which set a record in Zionist crimes and also demonstrated the ability to target a significant number of resistance fighters, Sheikh Naeem Qasim stated that there would be an internal investigation into how this occurred. How did the enemy manage to reach every home and every resistance fighter? Have any results emerged from the investigations? What information can you share regarding this matter?
Simply put, let me say that what happened confirms that there is a flaw, which is natural. Based on that, after the events that took place following the war, along with the pagers attack and other matters, and a strike on September 23, where some leaders and personnel were killed, two committees were formed. A technical evaluation committee to assess what occurred and a separate investigation committee. The investigation committee, as you know, will delve into the details and examine where the breaches occurred, where we succeeded, and where we failed. Overall, we can say that there is a breach. First of all, there is a technological gap in it. The other thing is that the enemy has also benefited from the human infiltration. Now, how deep is this infiltration? We are still working on it.
Does this mean we can say that this human infiltration exists within the structure of Hezbollah? Has it reached inside Hezbollah's framework?
Regardless of the internal structure of Hezbollah or its surrounding environment, ultimately there is a human element and a technological superiority that has led to certain outcomes. I believe that after some time, we might see results that are, let's say, if not final, than nearly final.
Will you release the reports?
Certainly, it means that first, on an internal level, we need to address what has happened, because if we don't tackle the mistakes we've made, then who will be responsible for correcting them? In reality, we're all human and everyone makes mistakes. We lose a battle, but we haven't lost the entire war.
I mean, after you reach the confirmations and the investigations prove the betrayers within the body of Hezbollah, those who assisted the enemy and were its agents, will you release this information or will it remain an internal matter?
This is related to the nature of the breach, its size, and sometimes the performance of the breach. People can sometimes exaggerate a simple issue, making it seem more significant than it is, and vice versa. This is connected to the security of the resistance in the military resistance apparatus. However, we must point out the areas of error that occurred, whether in assessment, evaluation, performance, tactics, or strategy.
Yes, regarding the assassination of Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah, was the breach a technological or a human one?
I believe that regarding this issue, the investigation committees have not yet completed their work.
But some results are starting to appear now.
I mean, no one knows exactly what happened before the investigation committees finished their work.
The enemy claimed a year ago, or during this war lasting 66 days, that they had eliminated 80% of the resistance strength. Yet Netanyahu continues to boast even now that he has significantly diminished or even eradicated Hezbollah. What do you have to say about that?
We faced a strong and harsh blow, particularly at the level of core leadership, especially with the loss of His Eminence Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah and Sayyid Hashem Safieddine, along with military leadership and field personnel, among others. However, the resistance remains present, alive and ongoing. This indicates that the blow that did not break our back strengthens us. We faced a blow, yet our structure is healthy, and I believe the path to recovery began the moment we gathered ourselves, so to speak, and managed to restore the positions of those we lost. And also, I can say that even on this first anniversary, our brothers who were injured during the pager attack have also recovered, and in their recovery, the resistance has also healed. Additionally, the restoration of the necessary alternatives is well known to everyone. Thus, we can now say that the resistance has returned to its former strong state, able to perform its tasks, fulfill its duties, and take on its responsibilities.
Yes, well, you agreed to the ceasefire agreement. You stood behind the state and entrusted President Nabih Berri and the Lebanese state to implement this agreement. If you could turn back time to before the ceasefire agreement, which was sponsored by the Americans and lacked any guarantees afterward, and which Israel has exploited to continue its aggressions against Lebanon in all its regions to this day, would you have agreed to this type of ceasefire? What options did you have?
Of course, we need to put things in perspective. I mean, let's take the moment and review the time when the ceasefire was declared and what happened with Hezbollah and how the resistance continued its military and security path until the ceasefire was reached. The enemy was the one who failed to achieve its goals and requested the Americans to intervene for a ceasefire. This indicates that at the moment the resistance agreed to the ceasefire, it had the capability and the resilience to continue. Furthermore, the resistance was indeed in contact with President Nabih Berri, who was also in touch with the party's leadership. Thus, as a result of exchanging points of view and making comments on the draft, this is what happened.
Do you regret agreeing to this type of agreement at the time?
The political, security, and military circumstances that existed during the negotiations, along with the manner in which they were conducted, played a significant role. We must not forget that the balance of power and its disruption influenced this situation. Therefore, the decision made was correct, and anyone in that phase, under the same conditions we faced, would likely have made the same choice. However, the fact of the matter is that the Lebanese state is the one that agreed, and the resistance committed to what it agreed to. Yet the sponsors of this agreement, who were supposed to guarantee it, failed to uphold their end, starting from the Americans to the French and even the Israelis. Consequently, when the opportunity was given to the state to fulfill its responsibilities fully on the basis of...
Do you think the state has fallen short in monitoring this situation and putting pressure on the occupation?
Of course, because from the very start moment, we noticed that the commitment was one-sided without the involvement of the other party.
Now you are being treated in Lebanon and outside Lebanon. Of course, we are talking about the various opposing groups with Hezbollah, I mean America and Israel, as if you have been defeated and therefore you must surrender your weapons. This was the government's decision on the 5th and 7th of August last year. Then there was a meeting in the government on the 5th of September and the army's plan. Today, how do you approach in Hezbollah this path that is working and is determined to disarm the resistance?
Well, there may not be much time to explain the topic of weapons and disarming the resistance exclusively. This term emerged after the Taif Agreement, which was a result of ending a nearly 15-year internal war. It happened because there was confusion regarding the weapons, meaning the disarmament of militias at that time, as the civil war had ended. They aimed to control the weapons that were considered uncontrolled and ensure they were in the hands of the state. This was accomplished abolished and the weapons of the resistance were also exempted. The proof of this is that in the first government after the Taif Agreement, led by President Harawi and with Prime Minister Salim Al-Hus, the ministerial statement embraced the resistance and its weapons, supporting the resistance to liberate Lebanese land.
ودعم المقاومة لأجل تحرير الأرض
اللبنانية. The government that supported the resistance and its weapons has changed. Now the government of today claims that Hezbollah is among the militias and we need to disarm it. So what are your thoughts on this? What is your position? How will you realistically deal with this plan?
ما في مشكلة.
There's no problem, so we consider the legitimacy of resistance to be valid and present. This is one aspect of the government's decision. If this decision is based on truth and objectivity, I would call it a major sin, because it contradicts the national charter. Therefore, it has exceeded the constitution. Considering that the preamble of the constitution is part of it, which violates the shared living in rejecting a fundamental component of this issue. Another point is that the legitimacy is supported by statistics or opinion polls, which show that 60% of the Lebanese people refuse to hand over weapons. This weapon, which I would say is legitimate and lawful, taking it away from the resistance does not have the charter or national support either. In reality, when we talk about disarming the resistance, it means stripping Lebanon of its power and ability. This weapon is for the protection of the homeland and its resources. We cannot allow this weapon to be taken away, and we have declared that it cannot be removed under any circumstances or pretext.
The time is up, but I have a question. I would like a brief answer, please. What would you do if you were faced with the army?
We are certainly eager to avoid confrontation with the army. And the army is equally cautious. However, in the end, when faced with the choice, let's say the option to die with honor or to die in surrender, we will never raise a white flag. If it comes to that, we will undoubtedly die the death of the honorable and the free. It is an honor when a person dies for a sacred cause.
Thank you very much, Honorable Deputy Sheikh Hassan Azzeddine, for this opportunity. Dear viewers, this brings us to the end of this episode. Thank you for
watching.
Every time I think of
شيئا وآخرا يا إلهي.
And all the enemies of the prophets were either themselves were oppressors or supporters of the oppressors.
Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. This is Foresight and I'm your host Mehdi. Please stay with us. Today's tip: following an oppressive leader will surely destroy our ubudiyah. Welcome back, dear friends. This is Foresight on IRIB English Radio. So we are talking about how following an oppressive leader will destroy our ubudiyah, our worship, our servitude, and our obedience to Allah. So this concept that we're talking about, it practically states that if an individual follows a leader who is oppressive, then they destroy their religion or they destroy their ubudiyah. So, of course, just to kind of shed a little bit of light on the subject, we find that the sixth divinely appointed Imam, Imam Sadiq alayhi salam, peace and blessings upon him, he says that one who subjects himself to following a oppressive leader unendorsed by the Almighty Allah has no religion. So, of course, when we're talking about religion, we have said throughout our programs that ubudiyah, the worship and the servitude and the obedience to the Almighty Allah, is religion. Religion is the ubudiyah, the worship and the servitude and the obedience to the Almighty Allah. And so, this religion that we have, this ubudiyah that we engage in all of its various different forms, this ubudiyah can be ruined and destroyed, and it can go to waste if we subject ourselves to following a leader that is oppressive. Now, we can give some very concrete examples that will very clearly explain this, concept that we're trying to put forth, and that is that if we subject ourselves to following a leader that is oppressive, we will destroy our religion, we will ruin our religion, we will destroy our ubudiyah, our worship, our servitude, and our obedience to Allah, which is what we're trying to do, is to increase our ubudiyah. But in this manner, we find that we might destroy our ubudiyah. And so, when we go into the past and we see that there were certain Muslim leaders that they didn't really follow Islam. And so because they didn't follow Islam, they claimed to be Muslims, of course, but because they didn't follow Islam the way that it was and it should have been followed, they committed a lot of oppression. Now, if an individual were to subject himself to following, the orders and obey this oppressive leader, then according to, other traditions, this individual who follows a leader that is oppressive is, in reality, part and parcel of the oppression of that individual. So, perhaps one of the most hated figures in all of the history of Islam is Yazid, the son of Muawiyah, of course, who killed Imam Hussein alayhi salam in the Battle of Karbala. What would we consider ourselves to be if we had followed him?
IRIB.
IRIB English Radio. Please follow our radio programs and podcasts on iranradio.ir. And now we invite you to listen to Sheikh Hamza Saudagar.
Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala in the Holy Quran says, A'udhu billahi min shaytanir rajim, qad kanat lakum uswatun hasanatun fi Ibrahim wal-lazina ma'ah. He says, you will find, and there has been an example for you, a good example for you to follow in Ibrahim and al-lazina ma'ah. We can take examples for those who have this question in their mind of non-ma'asumeen, according to this verse. الَّذِينَ مَعَهَ. When the movement of Imam Khomeini began, out of all the qualities that our late Imam Khomeini had, the one that is most outstanding, the one that we have felt the impact of in all the other dimensions, or because of this, is his political stances, is the impact that he had in the political world. He shook the entire globe. When the movement led by Imam Khomeini reached its success, what happened was there was a campaign by the Western countries, or led by the Western countries, against the movement of Imam Khomeini. Amongst what they have done, or what they did at that time, was to present the movement of Imam Khomeini in a way where the people of the world would not like the movement of Imam Khomeini. One of the areas that this occurred in regards to the movement of Imam Khomeini, was to present the model of the Islamic government to be a totalitarian government as opposed to a democratic system. Wilayatul Faqih, according to Imam Khomeini, especially with the emphasis on the mutlaqa part, that this is unconditional power that the faqih and the jurist has in the political system of Wilayatul Faqih, the way this was portrayed to the masses is that this is a dictatorship. One man has control over everything in this country. That's what the concept of Wilayatul Faqih is. In the Islamic political thought, the leader has a responsibility, the people have a responsibility. The leader is not going to force the people to do what is right. He's going to tell them, this is right. They get a choice, they don't want it. This is the Islamic system. The Islamic concept is people have the choice, whether they like it or not. All people are making choices. People in this country are making choices, people in the US are making choices, people throughout the globe are making choices, but they're either right or wrong choices. The difference between an Islamic leader, a Muslim leader, a divine leader, and a non-Muslim, non-divine, even if they call themselves Muslim, is that the leader that is divine never lies to the people. He tells them what's actually good for them. They may see the truth in that, they may not, but he is never going to lie to the people. A Muslim leader doesn't manipulate thought, doesn't fabricate the truth, but tells them what the truth is and guides them in the right direction. People follow, we're going to be successful. People don't, and they listen to the lies of the media, and that's when the others are going to be successful. It's been like that throughout history.
Mother, don't cry for me, I'm heading off to war. God Almighty is my armor and sword. Palestine, forever Palestine. stones in the sky, they say to their parents, don't worry, God is on our side. Palestine forever, Palestine.
Welcome back, dear friends. So we were talking about how following a oppressive leader will destroy our ubudiyah, our worship, our servitude, and our obedience to the Almighty Allah. So this now brings us to the present day. We talked a little bit about the past. We said that what would we consider ourselves to be? Would we consider ourselves to have religion? Would we consider ourselves to be religious? Would we consider ourselves to be engaged in a higher level of ubudiyah, worship and servitude and obedience to the Almighty Allah, if we were following somebody like Yazid, who, of course, historically we know killed the grandson of the Holy Prophet. He also ransacked the holy city of Medina, and he threw catapults and laid siege upon the holy city of Mecca. Of course, nobody would ever agree to be considered to be a religious person if they were to follow such a oppressive leader. So why limit our discussion to the past when Islam is, a eternal religion? It is a final, complete, perfect, and eternal religion. And on the other hand, we, with this in mind, the teachings of Islam must be applicable to the present day. And also, we are responsible, just like the people in their own eras are responsible for their actions at that time. Neither will they be blamed for our actions, nor are we blamed for their actions. So in the present day, when we find that, the fellow human beings, fellow Palestinian brothers and sisters, fellow Muslim brothers and sisters, and really fellow human beings, that's the most common denominator that we have. And it's a very strong denominator, right? But on top of that, there are also our Muslim brothers and sisters. We have a duty and a responsibility to help them. And one of the ways to help them, of course, is to not subject ourselves to follow oppressive leaders that are doing these things, right? If we subject ourselves to follow an oppressive leader, then, as the tradition that we stated from Imam Sadiq alayhi salam says, we have no religion, we have no ubudiyah. And so by following a oppressive leader, we are destroying our ubudiyah. We are ruining, pretty much the purpose, fundamental purpose too, of our existence, which is ubudiyah, the worship, the servitude, and the obedience to the Almighty Allah. So we have to be very careful. Ubudiyah is not just a very abstract, conceptual, metaphysical reality that disconnects us from this material and physical world. No, we have to be in this physical world. And not only do we have to be in this physical world, but as the Imams have taught us that, opposition to oppression, is one of the principles of Islam and is one of the most beautiful things about Islam, that it stands up to the bullies of the world, to the oppressors of the world, and it stands up for the downtrodden and the oppressed of the world. Thank you very much for listening to this episode of the program, Foresight. For more information, visit our website at iranradio.ir. Until another episode, God bless you and fi amanillah. Allah, la ilaha siwa, la tukhalituhu dhunub.
with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio.
Fiqh or jurisprudence is an Islamic knowledge and is ranked
the Holy Prophet of Islam is the example
of
self-purification is the most significant
factor.
Imamat is a living principle in the history of Islam and Shiism.
This is Ulama Speech, the best selection of the speeches of prominent Shia scholars.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. Well, welcome to another episode of the program Ulama's Speech. In this episode, we invite you to listen to the English translation of a short Farsi speech by Hujjatul Islam Qaraati. Please stay tuned.
یاک نعبد عقل میگه بشین فکر کن دیگران رفتنین بی خود
یاک نعبد intellect says think everyone else is transient don't go elsewhere may god have mercy on martyr mutahhari martyr mutahhari had come to kashan and I was in his company he said to me mr qaraati read this prayer every day he said This prayer is for the month of Rajab, but you need to read it every day. The prayer is, Fail are those who seek others than you, and lost are those who approach any but you.
Iyyaka na'bud. توکل علی الحی الذی لا یموت
And put your trust in ever living who never dies. All others will perish. Indeed, I will see the neglectful perish. The others will vanish and set like the sun. At the beginning of the prayer we praise, all praise is for Allah. Why? Because God is Lord of all the worlds. God is the most gracious. God is the most merciful. God is the master of the day of judgment. Well, if God is like this, then where else are you going? Cut your attachments to others. Thank you very much, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, for listening through the program Ulama's Speech, which was the English translation of a short Farsi speech by Hujjatul Islam Qaraati. To find out more about this program and our other programs, please log on to our website, iranradio.ir. We leave you in Allah's care and goodbye.
Greetings from Iran Radio. Here's a quick look at what's still ahead on your favorite station, thoughtfully curated to keep you informed, inspired, and connected. We begin with news. Right after the news, we invite you to listen to Spring of Truth. Next, enjoy a fresh edition of Radio Productions. Then stay tuned for Leader's Speech. Coming up next, news this hour. Stay with us.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Dozens more civilians are killed in Gaza as the Israeli military pushes ahead with its genocidal war against Palestinians in the besieged territory. And Caracas accuses the US of seeking to topple the legitimate government of Venezuela through its military buildup in the Caribbean Sea. And this is news. Iran has recalled its ambassadors from the UK, France and Germany for consultations after their move to reinstate UN sanctions against the country over its nuclear energy program. Iran's foreign ministry said the move was a response to the European Troika's irresponsible decision to trigger the snapback mechanism. The U.S.